Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Speaking of the American way, Russian TV, the Russian National TV Service, was in here Thursday night videotaping me. And that video is now up on their website at russiatoday.com. So just, and I was on Fox News on Sunday. That's not on anybody's website. But it was fun debating Mike Gallagher, as always. And the tip of the hat to the folks at Fox News. We have an extraordinary day today. Carrie Lucas in our second hour from the Independent Women's Forum is going to drop by. We'll be talking about McCain's corporate tax plan, the mortgage buyout and bailout and the haul, all this kind of stuff. Robert Greenwald is going to drop by with Brave New Films. Carrie Kerrigan, who of course does a show on Kudo, KUDO, our affiliate in Anchorage, Alaska, is going to drop by and talk about Troopergate. Wayne Pacell with the Humane Society of the United States in our third hour, and Karen Nussbaum, executive director of the AFL-CIO's Working America campaign. So an enormous amount of stuff going on today. We start out, and I want to get into it's Columbus Day, and I've got a little riff about that. And of course, the markets are up, and all the various activities. Frankly, I'd say most of the activities by the G8 countries. And I will be sharing with you my thoughts on that as we go through the day. But we are in the midst of a presidential election, and it is 23 days, as I recall, until the election. And in fact, you could argue that might be a good time to consider what the stakes are in this election. As one of our previous presidents said,
next Tuesday is election day. Next Tuesday, all of you will go to the polls, will stand there in the polling place and make a decision. I think when you make that decision, it might be well if you would ask yourself, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Is it easier for you to go and buy things in the stores than it was 4 years ago? Is there more or less unemployment in the country than there was 4 years ago? Is America as respected throughout the world as it was? Is as safe, that we're as strong as we were 4 years ago? And if you answer all of those questions yes, why then I think your choice is very obvious as to who you will vote for. If you don't agree, if you don't think that this course that we've been on for the last 4 years is what you would like to see us follow for the next four, then I could suggest another choice that you have.
Yeah, so the Gipper endorses Obama, I guess. Grace Marie Turner is the president and founder of the Galen Institute, their website, Galen, Galen.org. And Grace Marie, welcome to our show this morning.
Welcome. Nice to be with you, Tom. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Or I guess it's this afternoon on the East Coast. It's 9 o'clock in the morning here in Portland, Oregon.
Actually, I'm in New Mexico.
Oh, okay. Well, it's morning. It's 10 o'clock for you
right,
there.
Exactly. Yeah.
And Americans, as you note in a press release, Americans face a critical choice this election over the direction of our health care system. And you wanted to come on and essentially defend John McCain's health care package. Have at it.
Well, I think that there is a lot of misunderstanding. I was actually here visiting my mom. I'm based in Washington, but seeing a lot of ads that John McCain wants to tax your health benefits. And I don't think anybody thinks that that would make any sense.
No, he wants to tax
something,
the
you get less of it. Why would we want to do that? But what we want to do is to say to people, for tens of millions of Americans, the current health sector isn't working. And I think that the American people are saying, yes, we absolutely want change. And one of the things we need to do is to provide subsidies for health insurance, for private health insurance, that fit with our modern global economy, where 4 in 10 workers change jobs every year. And Senator McCain is saying in order to do that, we need to make health insurance more portable, and we need to make those subsidies fairer. Right now, the people with the highest incomes that are lucky enough to have job-based and health insurance and that have the most generous policies get the biggest share of the $200 billion in money that the federal government spends every year to subsidize private insurance by making it tax-free as long as you get it through the workplace. Senator McCain is saying, we want to give everybody the same deal. We're going to give families a $5,000 tax credit. It's refundable. You get it even if you don't owe that much in taxes. And you get it if you buy health insurance. And this would equalize, and actually be equalize the tax rebate of health insurance, but it would actually be a big tax cut for the great majority of Americans.
Okay, so Grace Marie, a couple of points here about this. First of all, as an employer who is providing health insurance to an employee,
mm-hmm.
I can deduct the cost of that employee's health insurance,
and
for that matter, my own health insurance, as a corporation or even as a sub-S corporation,
right,
from my taxes.
Mm-hmm.
If, as an individual, I went out into the workplace and tried to buy health insurance, it would not be deductible from my income taxes.
And that, if the company would still be able to deduct whatever they spend on health insurance, whether or not they call it compensation or health insurance, it's still a cost of doing business for the company. So the employer is made whole. There are actually two tax breaks for the employer side and the employee side. Employer side stays in place. On the employee side, it changes from this invisible tax break that people don't even know they get to this direct portable,
right,
refundable credit.
So, actually, my understanding was that John McCain was doing away with the deductibility to corporations. Has
yeah,
his plan changed significantly in the last couple
true.
Of months? Okay. All right. Then I stand corrected, or his plan has changed, because the last time we had this discussion with a representative of the McCain campaign, they said that they wanted to eliminate the deductibility at the corporate level. But
I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about
okay.
it.
Okay. Well, that's great.
Stays whole.
So what you're suggesting then with this $5,000 tax credit appears to me to be a direct subsidy of the health insurance industry. We have an industry in the United States where, for example, the second largest health insurance company in the United States, UnitedHealthcare, 2 years ago, front page of the Wall Street Journal, they paid William McGuire, their CEO, $1.78 billion in total compensation
outrageous.
Over a 10-year period.
Right.
$1.78 billion. We have a health insurance industry in the United States that's absolutely gold-plated. And by gold-plated, I mean literally gold-plated washrooms in the corporate jets, corporate headquarters that cost billions of dollars, massive advertising campaigns, CEOs and senior executives who are making millions, hundreds of millions, thousands of millions of dollars in compensation. Every $100 of money that goes through our private health insurance program, it ends up anywhere between 15% and 35%, depending on the company, being skimmed off and going to these corporate leeches, this very small number of leeches at the top of these health care insurance companies. On the other hand, every $100 that goes through Medicare, only 3% is the cost of administration, because we've got a bunch of government bureaucrats with green eye shades with nice, reliable union jobs and pensions taking care of it and never failing to make a payment. Why on God's green earth would we want to offer everybody in America $5,000 out of the Treasury of the United States to subsidize this god-awful, corrupt, outrageous industry that's giving its CEOs $1 billion in compensation when we've got a great single-payer system called Medicare that we could simply extend to every American?
Well, first of all, I'd refer you to a study by former Rand Corporation scholar Ben Zeiker, who has shown that if you actually count all the costs that go into Medicare, collecting the taxes to pay for it, all the administrative costs that are really not part of directly just running the computers, the cost of that program would be even more than
But I'd say insurance. You can take those back out again, because we're going to be collecting the taxes whether we have Medicare or not.
Well, if you do this tax credit,
if you're going to try to allocate part of the IRS's cost to Medicare, that doesn't make any sense to me. Why not allocate that to the Pentagon too?
Well, you ask people, do you want to have a program where you have control over your health insurance? It's portable, and you get to make decisions about your coverage.
With Medicare, you can go to any doctor you want as long as they accept Medicare. And if Medicare was for everybody, that would be every doctor in America. And you can, you know,
look at Medicare. Medicare, if you compare a Medicare program to private insurance, even insurance agents and individual seniors will tell you it's not very good. People have to buy separate.
Right, compared to the very wealthy ones,
drugs.
I agree. And that's because a minority of Americans have Medicare. When a majority of Americans have Medicare, they're going to say, we're not going to put up with this crap.
Well, and then you ask doctors who are saying that they can't take any more Medicare patients because they're not being paid enough. It's increasingly covering their costs.
Because it's a minority share of Americans. When all of us get some skin in the game, I think we'll fix it. People can read about it over at Galen.org. Grace Marie Turner, the president and founder of the Galen Institute, and, of course, JohnMcCain.com. Grace Marie, thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks, Tom.
It's great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. 21 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. My friend Rob Call wrote an op-ed over at opednews.com over the weekend. The mailer, I don't have it in front of me. My recollection is the phrase was something to the effect of, the mailer that will take down John McCain. 100 million Americans, roughly, received last week or will receive this week their 401k or IRA statements, their quarterly statements from their companies that manage their IRAs or 401ks. And what they're going to see, I don't mean to laugh. I'm sorry. This is a real tragedy. But for the McCain campaign, this is an absolute disaster. What they are going to see is that they're very much not better off than they were 4 years ago. And, Rob's point was there's nothing the Obama campaign could have done in a mailer that would be more effective at turning people against the Republicans in this. Because what we're seeing now is the consequence of 26 years of Republican rule. You know, very straightforward. And even Bill Clinton's economic policies, by and large, when he was president, particularly his trade policies, were driven by the Alan Greenspan, Robert Rubin, Lawrence Summers School of Economics. And we've gone from, can I manufacture that for you, to would you like fries with that? On the McLaughlin Group over the weekend, they were all, several people were discussing, hey, we don't make anything in America anymore. And therefore, Asia is going to be the emerging major economic power in the world. Why? Because they have manufacturing. This is Adam Smith 101. It's David Ricardo 101. You add value to things, and that's what drives an economy. So, Adam Smith's, concept, a piece of wood is only a piece of wood. If you turn it into an axe handle, it now has value. How does it now have value? It has value because you added human labor to it. That's why Abraham Lincoln said labor is superior to capital because it precedes capital. So we're seeing the markets up around the world, in large part because the Europeans and some of the Asian countries have said, we will guarantee interbank lending. This is one of the keys to this, to at least holding this thing for a few weeks or maybe a few months. Keep in mind, the goal of this administration is to prevent the bottom from falling out before November 5th. On November 5th, they're going to step back with a big smile on their face and say, pew, time for Wile E. Coyote. with regard to the economy, in my humble opinion. The LIBOR rate is the one that everybody should be looking at, and it's not pretty much published anywhere. You have to read the Financial Times to catch it, and even there it's only referenced in passing. It's the London Interbank Overnight Rate, LIBOR. And it's the rate that the banks charge each other overnight to loan money to each other, because you've got rich banks and you've got poor banks and kind of banks in the middle. And the rich banks traditionally have made a good chunk of their profits over the years lending money overnight to smaller and medium-sized banks. And the smaller and medium-sized banks have been able to loan money to you and to me to have mortgages, to make payroll for small businesses by borrowing money from the big banks. And then the big banks, they borrow money from the Fed. I think big banks mostly are the Fed banks. And what's happened is because so many of these smaller banks and medium-sized banks may be holding on to bad securities, nobody knows. Again, this stuff got tranched, it got sliced and diced, and nobody knows where all the cancer is in the system because it was completely unregulated. As Bill Simon pointed out in a speech last week, I'll be sharing more of that with you as the week goes on. This is the most shocking, startling, amazing piece of audio that I've run across in years. Bill Simon, the guy who was the chairman of the Resolution Trust Corporation, who put back together the S&Ls, he basically says this was all because Alan Greenspan said we have to trust in free markets. The market in derivatives was not only unregulated, nobody even knew how many there were out there. I mean, it literally, nobody knew how many there were. And when Seidman and his buddies said, you know, we ought to regulate this market or at least ensure some transparency, Alan Greenspan came in and said, oh, no, you can't do that. So anyway, what has happened is in the United States, the credit markets are still locked up because the one thing that Paulson did not do and that the Bush administration did not do is say we will guarantee interbank lending, overnight interbank lending. In other words, we will guarantee the big banks that if they loan money to the small banks and the small banks go south, we'll make it right. We'll make it right for them. And that is going to be a significant impediment to us here in the United States. Now, I expect that probably within the next 2 or 3 days, they will change that because probably the markets will start going south again after a day or two. There'll be some profit taking and, you know, we'll see. My guess is that they will do that. But none of that addresses the fact that the middle class in America is tapped out. The middle class in America is in debt on average between $7,000 and $9,000 per person on their credit cards. We have 10 million homeowners in America, maybe as many as 20 million, who are upside down in their mortgages. They can't borrow any more money against their house. They can't use their house as an ATM. And so consumer spending is going to it's going to hit the floor.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
I'd want your job. I can barely handle the simple one I got. And hey, Mr. President, how cool is Air Force One? Are those guys in the House and the Senate ever gonna get anything done? I ain't no Democrat. I ain't no Republican. We're fathers and mothers, we're wives and husbands, and we pray that we dance at our daughters' weddings, and our sons grow to fine men, and for peace on our land. Hey, Mr. President, how about that money I sent? Must take a lot of pork barrels to run the government.
35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the Teamsters. Proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Go to TeamsterSingular.org for more information. Hey, a shout out to our newest stations live this week, FM 105.7 WHJX in Jacksonville, Florida, FM 92.5 WFJO in Folkestone, Florida, and WZBK 1220 AM in Keene, New Hampshire. And so greetings. Welcome to our show, and our telephone number is 866-303-2270 for your reference. You can find that and all the information about the show over at TomHartmann.com and AirAmerica.com. And there's a Tom Hartman page over at AirAmerica.com. We have a live free video stream that we do every day that I'm here in the studio, live free audio streams, live free message board over at our site at TomHartmann.com, live free chat room where people can hang out and talk in real time during the show. You can get that at TomHartmann.com. So it's all there. It's all there. Check it out. So 866-303-2270, our telephone number, and Jeff in Detroit listening on WDTW. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind?
Hi. Okay, I really wanted to ask your last guest this question, but she was talking about, like, the John McCain's health care plan, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I'm total Obama supporter, right, total Democrat, but, I mean, honest, I mean, like, I'm also with, I mean, probably with you in the thought and belief that supply-side economics has proven to be a complete failure, right?
But, in fact, congratulations to Paul Krugman today for,
right,
being,
right.
for receiving the Nobel for, you know, this is the death of Friedmanism.
Right.
Both of them.
But, like, I mean, like, now this, but the John McCain's health care plan, and usually the most of the health care plans that Republicans pushed, you know, in recent years are with these, you know, individual insurance. I mean, on its face, most of these are consumer side, demand side based. You know, you're giving the credit to the consumer and you're having.
But what he's not doing, Jeff.
Right, but, it, and, but it's just.
No, hang on just a second. What he's not doing, that Barack Obama is doing.
Right.
And that he actually took from the John Edwards plan, which I think is the key to the whole thing, is letting people buy into Medicare. And
right.
Because the bottom line is, if everybody in America can buy into Medicare, then the big health insurance companies are going down because they can't compete. Medicare operates on a 3% overhead, and the big health insurance companies have 20, 30, 40% overhead. They can't compete. So if everybody can buy into Medicare, you got no more big health insurance companies, frankly, over time. It'll take a couple of years for them to all die out and go away. And there'll probably be a few, you know, like in Switzerland. I mean, there's a number of countries that have it like this. You can have the government-run program, or you can buy a private one. And so people, you know, with very high incomes buy private health insurance that allows them to fly anywhere in the world or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there will still be a place for health insurance companies, but they'll be radically diminished. The idea, though, of giving every American taxpayer, which is not every American, by the way, every American taxpayer, every person who files an income tax return, which is not even every person in the workplace. If you earn less than, I believe, $6,000 a year, you don't have to file an income tax return. But the idea of giving every person who files an income tax return $5,000 to buy health insurance, and only to buy health insurance, is to me, in my mind, simply a subsidy of a large, bloated, incredibly corrupt industry that, frankly, in my opinion, doesn't even deserve to exist. Dave in Oakland, California. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom. How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And thanks for informing people. I got really upset with this woman, Grace Marie Turner, when she said that my health care benefits, which I'm getting from my employer, are a unknown tax break. I find that ridiculous. I mean, I'm...
Yeah, so I'm saying your paycheck is an unknown tax break because that can be deducted by the employer from their cost of doing business as well. It's just like the logic that says, you know, the corporations don't pay taxes, people do because ultimately they always pass it along in the cost of the product, which is BS. Because actually,
right,
what happens is when corporations pay taxes, they recalibrate the cost of their goods and services, certainly to some small extent, but mostly they recalibrate the dividends that they pay their stockholders and the salaries they pay their CEOs. Those are the first and easiest places to cut the fat.
Yeah. Yeah. When you see something like you always bring up, like Malone at United Healthcare, this is just another sop to them.
Yeah, exactly. McGuire is his name, William McGuire. But, yeah, you're absolutely right,
sorry,
Dave. Well said. Thank you very much. Jared in Seattle. Hey, Jared.
Hey, Tom. I'm not really talking about healthcare, but I just kind of have a fundamental question because I hear all these talk radio shows on the left and right talking about democracy. Now, I just want to take a few steps back and ask, and actually state, I don't think democracy works. Do you, and do you have any examples?
Yeah. In fact, let me give you an example. First of all, I think for a long time it's worked in the United States, number one. Number two, no two democratic nations where the people elect their representatives or where the people make the decisions directly, and there are, I don't think, any major countries that are pure democracies like Greece was. In Greece, you had to have 6,000 people show up in order to make a decision, 6,001. And for the polis, right? If you didn't show up, then you were considered an idiota. That's where the word comes from. Somebody doesn't show up to participate in politics. But in any case, no two democratic nations have ever gone to war with each other, number one. So that tells me that there's something positive happening here. Number two, you look at the most highly democratic nations, the nations with very, very high levels of democratic participation, the Northern European countries in particular. What you find is that the quality of life there is really good. People pay very high taxes, but they choose to pay those very high taxes. Salaries go up in response to that. I would submit to you that taxes don't matter. In fact, I think that what we need to do is roll back the Reagan tax cuts, and I'll get into my rant on that in the next hour. But in any case, that's the bottom line. And if you look at animals, Conrad and Roper, two scientists at the University of Sussex back 10, 12 years ago, did a study. I wrote about this in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? They did this study with, asking the question. Somebody asked a question much like you just did. Is democracy viable? Is democracy actually biological? Is it a normal thing, or is democracy simply a noble experiment, something that we're all just doing because it's such a cool idea? And there were a bunch of red deer in the forest near the university. And red deer have alpha animals, alpha males, who everybody's always assumed were the leaders of the pack, right? So they put up all these cameras in the trees to watch the red deer and see how they engage in decision making. And every day the deer in the afternoon have to go to one of three watering holes to get a drink. And they have to figure out which watering hole to go to. And the assumption had always been that the leader, the alpha deer, would say, okay, guys, it's 3 o'clock, time to go to watering hole number two today. And everybody would follow. But that's not what happened. When they watched the cameras, what they saw was that let's say that there was 100 deer in the herd. And it wasn't a nice round number, but just to make it easy with percentages. So the deer randomly throughout the herd would start, while they were chewing their cuds or whatever deer do, I don't think they have cuds, but whatever the deer were doing, nibbling on trees and things, they would start pointing their bodies toward, their faces toward one of the three watering holes. And when the 51st deer, when 51% of them were pointing their faces, their heads, toward one of the three watering holes, then within a matter of moments or minutes, the entire herd would move in the direction of that watering hole. And very often the alpha deer was in the back going, hey, where'd everybody go? So then they thought, okay, let's make this, we've got to figure out a way to get the alpha deer to assert his authority, his leadership, right? So let's make it a dangerous environment. And you look at the Constitution of the United States, the founders put all these supermajority requirements in to amend the Constitution. You have to have, a two-thirds majority in the House and Senate, three-quarters of the states ratify it. The 60-vote rule in the Senate to break a filibuster, things like that. I mean, that was a rule that's not in the Constitution, but many of the things in the Constitution require supermajorities for the really important stuff. So anyhow, they said, let's amp the state's stakes up. And so they staked a predator, took a wolf or a fox or something like that, and staked it down near one of the watering holes. Or maybe even just the smell of a predator. I don't remember. It's been a decade since I read the study and since I wrote it in the book, What Would Jefferson Do? And I actually interviewed, one of these two scientists for the book, and it's all in there. So they're watching the deer, and the 49th deer is pointing toward hole number one, and everybody else is pointing towards two or three. And then the 50th deer, and then the 51st deer, and at that point they should have all gone to hole number one, but they didn't. And then the 52nd, 53rd, 54th, 56th, 57th, 58th, 59th, 66th, 162, 63, 63. And when the 66th deer was pointing toward the same watering hole, two-thirds of the deer were pointing toward it, they all went to that watering hole. So Conrad and Roper published this in Nature, and they got, and when I interviewed, I think it was Tim Conrad was the guy that I interviewed, one of the two scientists. And he said that he heard, after this was published, he heard from bug ichthyologists, bug scientists saying, we're seeing the same behavior among swarms of gnats. among fish. No, entomologists is bug guys, ichthyologists, fish guys, saying, you know, this is how schools of fish move so fast. You'd think it's like telepathy. It's not. They're all voting every time they move left or right by moving their bodies a little bit, and they have very fast peripheral vision, so they're voting like 100 times a second. Same with flocks of birds. Democracy is natural.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
I don't know. It's a damn good question. Welcome back. Talk radio for the rest of us. The Tom Hartman Program. By the way, Friday of this week, October 17th, 7 p.m., I'll be giving a speech and doing a book signing at the Democratic headquarters of the San Fernando Valley, DPSFV. That's in Van Nuys, California. And for more information, 818-995-DEMS. And their website is over at tomhartman.com. Our website, and in fact, I think I've got that. Hang on just a second. Here it is right here. It's dpsv.com. Oh, gee, that makes sense. And I hope it's .com, not .org. And then on Sunday from 2 to 4, I'm at the American Jewish University in Bel Air, and Stephanie Miller and I will be debating a couple of right-wingers at Jewish University, 2 to 4 p.m. on Sunday in L.A., in Bel Air, at the Jindy Auditorium. And to register for that, it's a phone number. And let me give you that phone number. You get ready to write it down, because you have to call this phone number to register if you want to see Stephanie Miller and me live on Sunday in L.A. debating a couple of right-wingers. The phone number is 310, as is common in L.A., 440-1246. 440-1246. And again, that information is also on our home site, on our homepage at tomhartman.com. So, Bill Seidman, as I mentioned earlier, the guy who brought us tranched securitization. No, seriously, this is Bill Seidman talking last week in Grand Rapids.
Why did anybody put their money in this? Why would anybody, knowing that these people, subprime means that they are not prime? Well, the genesis of that goes back to something called securitization and something called tranched, credit-rated securitization. Now, that was invented by one of the people who were operating in the RTC,
which he ran.
And namely, it was invented by me and our group.
So William Seidman, God bless him, you know, an honest Republican, says, yeah, we invented these things, but Greenspan was their big cheerleader.
Tranched, credit-rated securitization. What it simply means is you take a bunch of mortgages, you put them into a trust, and then you divide the trust up into sections, and you say the first section, all the mortgages will support payment of interest on the first section. And then after they're paid, you go to the second, then the third, and then there's a residual piece. That is the way that these mortgages, subprime mortgages, were put together. And then these pieces were sold all over the world. I remember when we invented this, Alan Greenspan said, well, this is a great new innovation. because we are spreading the risk all over the world, which, of course, is what we did, and for which, at this point, the world is, to say the least, blaming the whole financial crisis we're in on us.
Yeah, what a surprise. And William Seidman also said, and this is the guy that George Herbert Walker Bush put in charge of what turned out to be, turned out to cost us over $370 billion, the bailout of the SNLs. He put him in charge of the Resolution Trust Corporation. And Seidman actually did a brilliant job. He did a very, very good job running that. This is a guy that I have tremendous admiration for. And he's a straight shooter, and he's telling the story the way it is. Here he's talking about, okay, now we get to 2004, and in 2004, the investment banking industry went to the SEC and said, stop regulating us, stop this 12-to-1 leverage rule where we can only borrow $12 for every dollar we have in securities, and let us regulate ourselves. And it went up to 30-35-to-1, and here's Seidman about that.
It was proposed that their regulation, or at least disclosure, be required. And the industry fought it, and the Federal Reserve.
Now, this is 2004.
Under Alan Greenspan, vehemently opposed. And they made the argument, which you hear all the time, and I can remember Alan and saying, look, these are sophisticated contracts between knowledgeable buyers and knowledgeable sellers. No regulator can do as well as they'll do. So what do you need a regulator for? The market will regulate these. And he won the day. So among the list of our friends, along with me and others, Alan was clearly, I'd say, the key person responsible for the fact that we didn't even know how many of those contracts there were. And they were up in the trillions. So when AIG got in trouble, it turned out that they had one division with 400 people in it. They had 80,000 employees. They had 400 people in one division. They wrote all these contracts. They didn't report any of them. So they were, you'd say, gambling by writing these contracts. And when things started to go bad and they had to pay on these contracts, the whole monster, the largest insurance company in the world, went under.
Yeah, and this is William Seidman, the chairman of the Resolution Trust Corporation, the former chairman of the FDIC, and a good Republican, saying, you know, we did this thing. This was deregulation on steroids. It was Alan Greenspan promoting it. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman Show. Kerry Lucas, Vice President for Policy and Economics at the Independent Women's Forum, coming up next.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, it's Columbus Day. Greetings to you on our second hour. Kerry Lucas with us, the Vice President of Policy and Economics at the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org, their website. And, hey, Kerry, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
It's always great to have you here with us, Kerry. Kerry, I would like to put out what I believe is the best solution to our economic crisis right now, other than the obvious stuff around the edges that needs to be done, like, you know, reinstating the stat tax on security transactions and providing liquidity to banks and blah, 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 all this other stuff, you know, and let's do something about the individual homeowner the way Franklin Roosevelt did. But I think we need to roll back the Reagan tax cuts. I mean, this is just crazy. When Ronald Reagan came into office, the federal budget was operating pretty close to a balanced budget. Our total debt, which was the accumulation of all the money that we had borrowed from the Revolutionary War, which we fought on borrowed money, through the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, the Vietnam War, Korea, all of which were fought on borrowed money. The accumulation of all of that was less than $1 trillion, and Ronald Reagan took the top tax rate from the 71% that John Kennedy had it at, where he tightened up the taxes, and corporations were paying about 35% of the total tax load in the United States. And he cut that down to 27%, and he cut the corporate tax rate dramatically. So now corporations are paying less than 7%, and millionaires and billionaires are paying, you know, less than 35%. And in fact, if they make most of their money with stock dividends, which is how, you know, most major CEOs are reimbursed, or with dividends or the sale through the sale of the stock of their own company, they pay a maximum 15% tax rate. I say roll back the Reagan tax cuts.
Well, you're going to have to convince your candidate, Barack Obama, of that, because he has he said that even his the tax increases that he plans to levy on the top 5%, which is much, much more modest than what you're talking about there, he thinks that it's probably something he's going to have to postpone, because he recognizes that raising taxes will discourage economic growth and slow productivity, in particular for the small businesses, the many, many small businesses that file under the individual tax codes. So you got a lot of work to do there, Tom. You're clearly not going to convince me of this, but you're not even convincing a fairly far left-wing Democrat of the need of the good idea of raising taxes to 75% or whatever you want.
No, I agree with you, Carrie. I've got a big job to do. I think all Americans do. But the fact of the matter is that when Dwight Eisenhower was president, he was an advocate of the 91% tax rate on income over $2.3 million a year. You could make up to $2.3 million a year. $3.2 million a year. You can make up to $3.2 million a year and pay a relatively low tax rate on it. After that, it was 91%. And the fact of the matter is that from 1935, when that tax went into place, until basically 1980, when Reagan did away with it, Kennedy actually tightened it up. You know, in the Nixon-Kennedy debates, he said he was going to drop it down to 70%, but he was going to close so many loopholes that the rich would actually pay more. Kennedy came right out and called for a tax increase in those debates. I've got the audio if you want to hear it. Fact of the matter, but here's my point. During that entire period of time, from 1935 until 1980, we did not see the emergence in the United States of any robber barons, of any dynastic wealth, of any of these, you know, just massively wealthy people with like William McGuire, the guy, the head of the second largest health insurance company in the United States, taking $1.78 billion in compensation. It just didn't happen, because who wants to pay 91% income tax? People were paid $3 million a year. That was the rich in America during that period of time. And the result was that the middle class was very healthy.
Well, I'm glad that you admit that if you're taxing people at 91%, first I'd say, why stop there? Just take the whole kit and caboodle. Just go for 100%. Just knock it out entirely, so that because people aren't going to bother at some point to continue working. But I guess we are on the same page on that level. You know, I think that those at the top end up doing a lot of good for those of us at the bottom and in the middle, in terms of creating jobs, creating wealth, creating the investment. But I won't even take that a step further, because you look at somebody like Bill Gates, and he's obscenely wealthy. Absolutely, there's no reason for anybody to have as much money as he has for their own consumption. But you look at the amount of good that man has done in terms of investing in schools throughout the United States and preventing diseases in places like Africa. There's actually something I think that when people have so much money that they get to look at the big picture, it's not an unhealthy thing for society.
You realize, Carrie, you're arguing
so much philanthropy.
You realize you're arguing for noblesse oblige. You're making the argument that was made during Victorian times in England for why we had to have kings and queens.
Well, you're arguing for full-on socialism or communism there.
I'm
slavery, saying that people are going to...
You can call it whatever you want.
Almost 100% of what you're going to take.
I'm saying, if we're going to make decisions as a society about how we're going to educate our children, how we're going to fund education, how we're going to improve our schools, how we're going to stop disease in Africa, that those decisions shouldn't be made by one man.
Well, but one of the things...
They should be made by you and me, too.
You know, it's actually something that I think is... There's a lot of public money out there, but there is something also to private money. And one of the things that we've seen with the difference between projects that are monitored by somebody like the Gates Foundation is that they have... real oversight. They are much better run. You get a lot more bang for your buck for with private charities and with a lot of those things than you do with public money, because public money often ends up, and I, you know, you're very suspicious of big organizations, and we all know that a lot of big organizations, including bureaucracies, end up being much more about sustaining the bureaucracy, paying the administrators, growing the administrative budget. It happens under Republican and Democrat administrations that people become much more interested in, oh, we can't save any money. We have to spend down or else they'll cut our budget.
You know, I'll acknowledge that there are occasionally problems with bureaucracies. But, Carrie, perhaps Bill Gates is not even the best example, and maybe you'll agree with me on this, because most of his fortune comes from his owning shares in a company that he started rather than executive compensation. And that's, you know, that's the American way to a large extent. Now, you could argue that what he has created is a monopoly, and the European Union has argued that, and therefore should be illegal, but or at least in its business practices. But that's a whole separate argument. So I'm not so much outraged by Bill Gates's wealth as I am William Maguire's wealth, taking $1 billion as a paycheck. What, you know, a $3 million a year, that's the point at which, $3.2 million a year is the point at which it used to kick in that you'd start paying 91% taxes on your money over that. $3 million a year, that's $1 million every 3 months, that's $300,000 every month, that's, about $80,000 a week, which is about $11,000 a day. What could anybody possibly do? Please tell me, what could anybody possibly do that is such a unique skill set, such a rare skill set, that any company should have to pay more than $12,000 a day for it?
But you know, I think that you get into a slippery slope, and we can all look at what athletes make, what rock stars make, and think what people in Hollywood make, and think this is stupid. You know, absolutely.
But see, they didn't make that much during the 50s. You know, how you had, you know, Walter Cronkite in the 1950s was making $36,000 a year. People, the stars did not make that much money back in the 50s and 60s, because once they hit $3.2 million a year, it was a 91% tax rate, so they said, screw it. And I mean, today we have stars who are creating dynasties, family dynasties. That didn't happen in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, or in the 40s. And I think that's a healthy thing for society, not to have the landed gentry, not to have the wealthy few among us. That was the vision of our founders, Carrie.
But no, the vision of our founders was freedom. And what you're talking about is basically micromanaging. You don't think it's fair, or you don't think it's a good idea that some Hollywood executive decides to pay some actor $10 million. I think it's probably stupid too. But is that my decision? What do I care? This is totally somebody's right to decide through that transaction that that I'm going to pay some starlet to appear in this movie.
Jefferson argued very strongly in favor. Let me just make this point real quickly. Jefferson argued very strongly in favor of a tax on wealth, because he said, we never want to see in America the landed gentry that we had in Europe. And that's the effect. That's why Teddy Roosevelt proposed an estate tax, an inheritance tax. And that's why Franklin Roosevelt raised that top tax to 91%. And it worked.
Well, I think that this comes down to a basic idea of who you think should decide. You know, somebody like Bill Gates has decided that he doesn't want his, I don't know how many children he has, but he doesn't want his heirs with obscene amounts of money because it thinks it'll warp his mind. So he's decided to give most of it to this foundation and have them.
Right, so if it warps people's mind, why should he have it in the first place?
Decide this. But I think that it's just the height, you know, you're worried about a landed aristocracy that makes these decisions.
I am.
And you want government to make it. I'd rather be individual people than government.
Government is us. It's a democracy. Government is us.
But it's tyranny of the majority the way
it is. Tyranny of the majority is exactly what democracy is. Carrie Lucas, Vice President for Policy and Economics at the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org. Carrie, it's always great talking with you. Thank you.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, Viagra for your brain. John McCain seems to have anger management problems. This is a clip from a new Brave New Films film out about John McCain's anger problems.
He is uncontrollable. He does not think before he acts.
He has a very disturbing penchant for erupting unpredictably.
I've seen the dark side, as they say, of John McCain.
I will confess to you, my friend, that I get angry.
This is not passion. This is deep anger, hostility toward other human beings.
Never forget, walking back to the Capitol, and we were talking to Senator Worth about pulling off his hold. It was a hold, it was blocking the legislation. And he didn't want to do it. And McCain just got mad as could be and started pointing his finger into Worth's chest, you know. McCain blows his temper, and when you move in close to him, he has a difficult time coping with that.
John confronted the head of the Young Republicans at that time and began to poke him in the chest, as is his custom when he's angry and up close to someone.
A group of about two dozen of us went to the Senate Russell building in the hopes of talking with Senator McCain. When we saw McCain and a young woman come from his office, I then saw the niece of a missing man. She stepped forward, but before she could say anything, McCain backhanded her. She hit the wall, and it was so loud that it resonated in the hallway.
This is from the new documentary. You can find it at bravenewfilms.org. Robert Greenwald, the guy who made this documentary, is on the line with us. Robert, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be back with you.
Robert, you have to ask yourself, is this, and I think, frankly, anybody watching this very disturbing documentary that you've done has to ask, is this really John McCain? I mean, is this a huge pattern that runs throughout his life? Is this a kind of daily or regular occurrence? Or were you able, out of a 26-year public career, to pull the six or eight times when he blew up, as I'm sure probably most people would over that period of time at least, and string them together? I mean, or is this something in between?
Well, it's, again, I'm not with him every day, but as you know, Tom, we spend as much time on the videos we do, making sure they're accurate in every sense. We have heard for over a year stories from numerous Washington, D.C. folks, people on committees, communications director, chiefs of staff, over and over and over again, many of them Republicans, saying McCain's temper scares the hell out of them. And that's really, plus some partners who said to us, it's really important to talk about this. So I don't believe he loses his temper every single day, but I do think the temper and the impetuousness, the gambling, the erratic behavior, it is consistent from a psychological point of view, right? And we're seeing more of that now. And it's hurt him. It's hurt him deeply in his campaign, not the temper specifically, but certainly the erratic behavior, suspending one day, back another day, the things that have come through in the debate. So the timing of releasing this has been very important. And we're almost 800,000 people have seen it, which means, again, that your listeners and others are seeing it and passing it around. But we had no trouble finding 5, 6, 10, 15 people who were willing to talk to us about the temper. We did have trouble finding people high up in the Republican Party who previously had been on record who would, in fact, no longer talk about it.
Right. Well, at a certain level, that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
They're all running for cover right now. And if he is president, then he will be in a position, this very angry man will be in a position to extract revenge.
Yes, and people are, again, including senators who spoke out about this, you know, we have the quotes in there, are careful not to publicly offend him. But one of the great things about the new media, and you and I have discussed this, is that we can tell these stories, we can use interviews, we can use clips, and then people really decide, does this ring true, and do I want to let other people know about it? And that's the That's the power of the real democracy, right? Or the true free market, if you will. Not right. The so-called free market on Wall Street, which is the last thing from a free market.
George Bush famously gave the finger to the camera, uses obscenities constantly. I guess in the new movie W, which I haven't seen, there's a there's a fair amount of obscenity. And gets very angry. He famously said when asked why he was attacking Iraq, you know, that man tried to kill my daddy. You know, we may already have seen the result of a president who has anger issues playing them out on an international stage. This should give all Americans pause, don't you think, Robert Greenwald?
I think so. And again, it's the work that we're continuing to do at Brave New Films with the help of you and your audiences. We've just passed, 11 or 12 million views now on our Real McCain series. There's the Real McCain and the Real McCain pack. And we continue to try to spread the word.
And what's the website for that, Robert?
It's therealmccain.com or therealmccainpack.com.
Therealmccain.com.
Yep.
Great. And, of course, bravenewfilms.org.
Yep.
Robert Greenwald, producer, director, political activist, and all-around great guy. Robert, thanks for dropping by today.
Pleasure, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, Kerry Carrigan, morning talk show host at Kudo about Troopergate.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. The Tom Hartman Program, 34 minutes past the hour. Barack Obama, this from the Detroit Free Press, just out, just flagged. Barack Obama will announce a wide-ranging economic rescue plan in Toledo this afternoon that includes an additional $25 billion more to help automakers retool plants and jumpstart production, give a tax credit to companies adding U.S. jobs, extending unemployment benefits, and allowing penalty-free withdrawals from retirement and 401k accounts this year and next. The plan also calls for a tax cut for most working families, $1,000 per family, which could be mailed out immediately based on last year's tax returns, as well as a voluntary 3-month moratorium on home foreclosures for homeowners who are making good faith efforts to pay their mortgages. He's calling for these plans to be enacted now, 3 weeks before the election, saying the nation has already lost 750,000 jobs this year and unemployment is on the rise. Wow. This is a political masterstroke. Kerry, speaking of the election, Kerry Carrigan is with us, the PD and morning show host at News Talk 1080 AM Kudo, K-U-D-O, Alaska's progressive voice, kudo1080.com, their website. Hey, Kerry.
Good morning, Tom. Good to be with you.
Always great to have you back on the show. Over the weekend, or I guess it was Friday, the Alaskan legislature released this report.
Right.
My understanding, my recollection is it was 10 Republicans and 4 Democrats. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Eight and 4, yeah.
8 and 4, thank you. And so this was 2-1 Republicans over Democrats. 8 Republicans, 4 Democrats released this report. And Sarah Palin went on national television. Actually, she didn't do a press conference, but she said to somebody in front of a camera in a way that it got picked up and distributed that she was so glad that she had been exonerated, that she had been, you know, that it had been proven now that she didn't break any laws. Is that what it said?
Yeah. And not only did she did that, but she called it Tasergate, too. In an effort to try and distract what the focus of the investigation was off of it being Troopergate, over her firing the head of the troopers, into being focused on the fact that there was a taser incident with this ex-brother-in-law of hers and his son.
Right. And by the way, for the record, he didn't shoot his son with a taser.
Yeah.
He had the training block
right.
That's got a couple of electrodes on it where you can put your fingers on them and get a small shock relative to what a taser is just so you can feel what it's like. And he let
right.
the kid do it at the kid's request.
Yeah, because the kid wanted to tell his friends he was tough and he knew what a taser was like.
Yeah.
Right.
And so this is just, you know, come on, give me a break.
Yeah, it is. And
if I was 12 years old, my dad brought something like that home, I'd say, hey, I want to try that.
Yeah, I'll tell him I'm tough in eighth grade, you bet. You know, she also said that neither she nor Todd had anything to apologize for, by the way. She, and this was in a press conference where it was 5 minutes and 30 seconds long. There were only three crews invited in, the Daily News, the newspaper, I've heard the Anchorage Daily News,
right.
Also, the NBC affiliate, KTUU, and the CBS affiliate, KTVA. So didn't even invite all the press crews, not all of the TV crews or any radio stations. Everybody got one question, no follow-up. That was it.
Wow.
This woman,
people have been making all these analogies, but Carrie Kerrigan from Kudo 1080.com, Carrie, I say this woman is George Bush with lipstick.
She absolutely is. The Huffington Post, there's a blog on there I read this weekend that I thought was very revealing. It's the one about body politics by Kathleen and Gay Hendricks.
Mm-hmm.
And people should look at that, and then they should go on and check out some of the earlier video of Sarah Palin. If you really want to get a feel for this woman and what's going on with her, you ought to look at some of her early press conferences and early videos, and then look at the ones that happened right as Troopergate breaks, where she's saying, I did nothing, none of my family did anything, we'll be totally exonerated, ask all the questions you want, and then look at her now. And boy, you can really get a vivid picture of what's going on here.
So for those of us who haven't done all that, tell us, what is that picture that we will see?
You'll see her as being open, wanting to talk to the media, wanting to be there. She still lies a lot, which is, that's just, I guess, inherent in her personality. But
that's one of the things, by the way, that bothers me so much, is she lies with a smile on her face and apparently no problem at all. John McCain, when he lies, he twitches.
Right.
You know, it's really obvious that he's very uncomfortable when he lies.
Yeah.
She lies the way George Bush lies. Just, hey, here's a smile, here's a lie.
Yeah, and you can see him do all the standard things that you see with body English. But with Sarah Palin, from that pageantry that she's had, that she's been indoctrinated
into being
in front of a camera. Yeah, and being in front of judges and being graded for her performances, she knows how to stand there and just bald-faced lie to you and stare you straight in the face, give you a wink and a smile, and she'll do it. But you can see a difference in her trying to be opening and think she has a mastery of the media to where she gets now, where she's kind of being held back. And I think if they didn't hold her back, I think she would think in her own mind that she was able to take these guys on and she'd have at the national media. And I think that would be a total debacle, but...
Be interesting to see. I mean, it's amazing to think that we have somebody running for vice president of the United States, 72-year-old heartbeat away from the presidency, with somebody who's had cancer four times, deadly cancer, who has never had, since she was nominated for vice president, a real press conference.
Yeah, and she used to have press conferences all the time. I mean, let me give you a short list here. New Yorker, People, Time, Newsweek, Fortune, Forbes, British Magazine, Monocle, New York Times, The Post, The Wall Street Journal, MTV, National Public Radio. I mean, the list goes on and on of people that she talked to. I mean, even when she was getting the Vogue interview up here, she stopped in the middle of her Vogue interview to talk to a news crew that showed up to ask her about what was going on with some other political issues.
Right. So
I mean,
as governor, she had no problem with talking to the press.
Now, all
of a sudden, she's got nothing to say. And
yeah.
It could be because as governor, she knew Alaskan issues inside out. She grew up there. But as vice presidential candidate, she really knows very little about national issues and international issues.
Yeah, and I think they're trying to protect her as well to a certain extent. I think part of the issue as well is that the Republicans want to try and guard her as much as possible so that they can pull her out of their basket again and, fluff her up and throw her back in front of the public in 2012 maybe.
Yeah, there you go. Well, Carrie Kerrigan, thanks a lot for setting us straight, getting it all out here with us, and for the great show and the great work you're doing there on KUDO in Anchorage, KUDO1080.com, the website.
Thanks. My best to Higgins.
Thank you, Carrie.
Okay.
You got to come visit us sometime. You can try to pet him.
Okay, thanks.
Good talking with you. 41 minutes past the hour. I want to do just a real quick riff, and then we'll take your phone calls about Columbus. Today is Columbus Day. This, by the way, I wrote this first decade or more ago. It's in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. When Columbus first landed on Hispaniola, the island down there that we call Haiti now, in 1492, almost the entire island was covered by lush forest. The Taino Indians who lived there had an idyllic life prior to Columbus, from reports left to us by literate members of his crew like Miguel Queno. When Columbus and his crew arrived on their second visit to Hispaniola, however, they took captive about 1,600 local villagers who had come out to greet them. Queno wrote, quote, and this is a guy who was there with Columbus, wrote, "When our ships were to leave for Spain, we gathered 1,600 male and female persons of those Indians, And of these, we embarked on our ships on February 17, 1495. For those who remained, we let it be known to the Spaniards who manned the island's fort that in the vicinity, anyone who wanted to take some of them could do so to the amount desired, which was done. Cuneo further notes that he himself took a beautiful teenage Carib girl as his personal slave, a gift from Columbus himself, and that when he attempted to have sex with her, quote, she resisted with all her strength, end quote. So in his own words, quote, he thrashed her mercilessly and raped her, end quote. This is him bragging about this. It was a common reward for Columbus's men for him to present them with local women to rape. As he began exporting Taino as slaves to other parts of the world, the sex slave trade became an important part of the business. As Columbus himself wrote to a friend in 1500, this is from Christopher Columbus's letters, quote, 100 castellanos, that's a Spanish coin, are as easily obtained for a woman as for a farm, and it is very general there, and there are plenty of dealers who go about looking for girls. Those from 9 to 10 years old are now in most demand, end quote. When Columbus once referred to the Taino Indians as cannibals, there was then and today still no evidence that this was so. It's apparently a story he made up, which is still taught in many U.S. schools, to help justify his slaughter and enslavement of the people there. He wrote to a Spanish monarch, to the Spanish monarchs, the King and Queen of Spain of 1493, "It is possible with the name of the Holy Trinity to sell all the slaves which it is possible to sell. Here there are so many of these slaves, and also Brazil wood, that although they are living things, they are as good as gold." However, the Taino turned out not to be particularly good workers in the plantations, and the Spanish and the French later established on Hispaniola, the Taino resented their lands and children being taken and attempted to fight back against the invaders. So Columbus sought to impose discipline on them. For every minor offense, an Indian's nose or ear was cut off, so he could go back to the village to impress the people with the brutality of the Spanish. Columbus attacked them with dogs, skewered them on poles from anus to mouth, and shot them. Eventually, life for the Taino became so unbearable that, as Pedro de Cordoba wrote to King Ferdinand in a 1517 letter, quote, "As a result of the sufferings and hard labor they endured, the Indians choose and have chosen suicide. Occasionally, 100 have committed mass suicide. The women exhausted by labor have shunned conception and childbirth. Many, when pregnant, have taken something to abort and have aborted. Others, after delivery, have killed their children with their own hands so as not to leave them in such oppressive slavery," end quote. Prior to Columbus's arrival, most scholars placed the population of Haiti, Hispaniola, at around 300,000 people. By 1496, it was down to 11,000, according to a census done by his brother Bartholomew. By 1516, the indigenous population was 12,000, according to Las Casas, who was there. By 1542, fewer than 200 natives were alive. By 1555, every single one on the island was dead. And today, we celebrate Columbus Day. 45 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back with your calls after this.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Minutes before the hour, Tricia in Albany, New York, on the line. Tricia, thanks for waiting so long.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
Well, I heard you mention that we have a democracy in this country, and I just wanted to clarify for the listeners what form of government that we actually have.
Mm-hmm.
I think you probably know this, but there's a lot of confusion on this topic.
And
actually what we have is a republic, which is a more centralized form of government.
Yeah, let me give you the history of this. In 1796, if you were to look in Webster's Dictionary from 1786,
mm-hmm.
the year before the Constitutional Convention was convened, mm-hmm. if you looked up republic or democracy in the Webster Dictionary, and that was basically the only dictionary that was used in the U.S., both terms were defined as being identical.
Okay.
And James Madison was trying to sell the Constitution, and which was a good thing, and along with Alexander Hamilton, and there were a few others. John Jay and George Mason also wrote, I think, or participated in writing a couple of the Federalist Papers. But basically, most of the Federalist Papers were written by either Alexander Hamilton or James Madison. And, or, excuse me, or Alexander Hamilton. Alexander Hamilton, yeah, or James Madison. And in Federalist, as I recall, 14, might be Federalist 12, I'd have to go back and look, but I actually wrote an op-ed piece about this, and you'll find a chapter about it in, I think it's in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? Madison, in an effort to sell the Constitution, created a distinction between the two words and said that a democracy is a rule of the people directly, which technically is true. Right. Well, no, he actually said it could have undesirable consequences.
Okay.
But the biggest problem was that America being such a large nation, it wasn't practical. Because in ancient Greece, if you got 6,000 people together in Athens was a city state. You know, everybody lived close enough that for 6,000 people to show up and, you know, just, you know, citizens and make a decision, that worked. So what Madison pointed out is what we have is, he said, we need to have a republic, which is what the Roman system of government was, which is where you have elected representatives.
Right.
And he argued in favor of it being a republic. And that's why the party that he and Thomas Jefferson founded was called the Democratic Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
And he called for it to be a democratic republic in as much as it's a republic, that is a nation of laws and elected representatives, but one that is based on a democracy, that is the majority of the people voting for their representatives.
Right. But so, democratic is the adjective describing
the republic. You're right. But if you want to be absolutely precise about it,
mm-hmm.
what we have is a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic. That's
right.
The form of government that we have. And what's particularly interesting about Madison's creating this artificial distinction between these two words, or this distinction, you can argue it's not artificial, is that later in his life, and again, I referenced this in What Would Jefferson Do? Later in his life, he was asked this specific question, is this a democracy or a republic? And he came back, now this was in the 1830s, this was after he was president, and he came back in 1836, as I recall, and he came back and he said, no, that's a democracy. He completely changed and said it's more important that we focus on the democracy aspects of this, that is, the rule of the people, than on the Republican aspects of it, that is, the decision-making being done in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
So your point is well taken, and you're right, that we're a republic, but this is how it got reprised. Up until about 30 years ago, everybody called this a democracy. I mean, there was a period in the early founding for the first 20 or 30 years of the republic when it was referred to as a Republican form of government because they wanted to distinguish themselves from the Federalists.
Mm-hmm. Well, the terms changed in definition, too.
Right, and that changed when the Federalist Party imploded in the 1830s. When the Federalists went down and the Democratic Republicans said, okay, that's it, we're going to stop referring to this as a republic, and they dropped the word Republican. And it became the Democratic Party. The party that Thomas Jefferson founded became the Democratic Party, and it always had been the Democratic Republican Party.
Okay.
But it became the Democratic Party. That's why it's not the Democrat Party. It's the Democratic
right.
Party.
So today, is it true that we don't exactly vote for the president? We vote for representatives.
That's right. Well, we vote for an electoral college. That's a whole other thing. That was a remnant of the Wicca Gemeinschaft, the Council of Wise Elders that England had before the Norman invasion in 1099.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the point. In the 1970s, in the 1960s and 70s, the early protege or the forerunners of Karl Rove and Frank Luntz said, you know, calling America democracy, which had been fashionable from 1830 until 1980, everybody called America a democracy. Just go back and look at newspapers, articles, presidential speeches. Everybody referred to this country as a democracy. In the 1980s, starting, you know, with Reagan and Lee Atwater and all those guys, they said, you know, democracy sounds too much like Democratic Party. We got to stop calling this thing a democracy and start calling it a republic again. And so the right-wing talk shows, and Neil Bortz is probably one of the most outspoken on this, but the right-wing talk shows all started this campaign, and Limbaugh really picked it up in 87.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. picked up this campaign to redefine America as a republic, because that sounds more like Republican Party rather than a democracy, which sounds like Democratic Party.
Well, so, it doesn't really matter what you call it. What,
no, it doesn't, exactly, but it's very interesting that for political purposes, it was called a republic from the time that the Constitution was written in 1787 until the 1830s. Then from the 1830s until the 1980s, we called it a democracy. And then mm-hmm. since the 1980s, there's been a very, very strong move on the part mostly of Republicans and partisans within the Republican Party to call it a republic again. And that's why I say, you know, well, let's call it what it is. It's a constitutionally limited, representative, democratic republic.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tricia. And thank you for providing me with an opportunity to riff on one of my very favorite topics, which is the history of the founding of this country and what the founders were thinking and what they were going through. Because it's just fascinating how, you know, language is a reflection of the thinking of the times. It's a reflection of the memes of the times. And the memes of the times are a reflection of the politics of the times. And the politics of the times are, you know, sometimes healthy and sometimes toxic. It's fascinating. Wayne Pacelle is going to join us at the top of the next hour of the Humane Society of the United States, Proposition 2 in California. I don't know if you read the funny thing. I read the comics every morning. And there's one in particular that's been talking about obliquely this. And also, I want to mention Prop 8 again. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to our program, the third hour of our show. Tom Hartman here with you. Last week, one of the callers to our show, we were talking about Prop 8 in California. We're on a lot of radio stations on the West Coast in California. We're on a lot of radio stations all across the United States, but this is a big deal in California. And frankly, one of the reasons why Prop 8 is a big deal is because it gets the right-wingers out. Prop 8 is the anti-gay marriage proposition. And I just wanted to set that one straight. One of our callers said, gave out some misinformation. The way to vote on Prop 8, if you're opposed to an amendment banning gay marriage, is to vote no. And the best website for that is noonprop8.com. Noonprop8.com. Now, there's another proposition on the California ballot, and I've been very pleased to see. And again, you know, keep in mind, California, if it was a country, would be the sixth largest economy in the world. This is a substantial chunk of the United States. Mutz, one of my favorite little comic strips in the Sunday paper and in today's paper as well, they've been plugging a website, humanecalifornia.org, which is yes on Prop 2. And Proposition 2, let's get Wayne Pacelle, the president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, hsus.org. And, of course, humanecalifornia.org. I don't know if they're affiliated with you or if it's separate, Wayne. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. Tell us about Prop 2 and also in the larger frame, other efforts around the country to make life a little better for factory-farmed animals.
Right. Well, a lot of people associate the Humane Society of the United States, the group that I am president of, with dogs and cats and horses, and certainly that's a major part of our focus at the organization. We're very active nationally and internationally on a wide, wide range of animal welfare issues. But we also do care about the welfare of animals raised for food. In the 1950s, we were the architects of the Humane Slaughter Act to stipulate that animals slaughtered for human consumption be rendered insensible to pain prior to being killed. Now, most of us, and certainly the vast majority of your listeners, would accept that as a legitimate principle. If animals are going to be killed for food, they should not be inhumanely killed. They shouldn't be, you know, butchered alive.
Yeah, didn't Sinclair Lewis kind of raise this issue back in the 1900s?
Exactly. 1906, it was Upton Sinclair.
Thank you. I mangle my Sinclairs.
No, I get them confused sometimes. But he wrote The Jungle, which talked about the mistreatment of workers at slaughterhouses, the He was trying to write an exposé of the working conditions, and as he described the slaughterhouses, there was a huge reaction about the mistreatment of the animals. Mm. He said he aimed for their heart and he hit them in the stomach.
Yeah.
So anyway, humane slaughter has been a big concern, but really, if you were to look at an animal's life, the vast majority of animals raised for food spend time on the farm prior to slaughter. But unfortunately, many of these farms have turned into factories, and the animals have been treated like things and commodities and objects, and they've been crammed onto these massive factory farms, with some of the animals, like veal calves, breeding pigs, and laying hens, jammed into cages barely larger than their bodies, unable to engage in any natural behaviors, and frustrated from even turning around and engaging in any movement at all. They're effectively immobilized. Proposition 2 is an effort backed by the Humane Society of the United States, by the California Veterinary Medical Association, and by 1,000 other endorsing groups and leading individuals, politicians or leaders of major entities. And it seeks to stop the intensive confinement of those animals, the veal calves, the breeding pigs, the laying hens, and to allow them to lie down, stand up, turn around, and extend their limbs. It's a very, very modest, moderate measure. It just says that if you're going to raise these animals for food, don't torment them during the preponderance of their lives.
Right. And this is – now, tell me what you think of this. This is something that has – I've thought about since I became a vegetarian when I was 16 years old. We share a biological archaeology or architecture with particularly mammals, but really, you know, all the animal kingdom. And adrenaline in a human is the same as adrenaline in a pig or a cow. I don't know about chickens, but adrenaline is a hormone that produces a stress response. And adrenochrome, you know, its breakdown product, and then there's hundreds of other neurochemicals and you know, neuropeptides that are associated with stress and anxiety that modulate our immune system and modulate our emotions, that are identical to the same chemicals in the bloodstreams and brains of animals. And so it seems to me that if somebody regularly ate animals who died in excruciating agony and lived in horrible terror, that they would be filling their bodies with hormones and chemicals that trigger their brains into states of anxiety.
You know, I think it just stands to reason that if you mistreat animals and you put them in a state of terror and extreme discomfort, then they're not going to be producing healthy products for humans to eat. Now, there are all sorts of other health-related issues that relate to these factory farms, including pumping animals up with antibiotics because the living conditions are so unhealthy that the animals have to be dosed with antibiotics for non-therapeutic reasons just to prevent the onset of disease. And then you have antibiotic-resistant bacteria developing in these environments, which renders antibiotics for us, because the small class of antibiotics that fight these infections are those are the same ones that we use and that are being used on the animals.
I think most people don't realize that E. coli H157, the deadly strain of E. coli, actually is a recent evolutionary product, you know, much to the discomfort of people like Sarah Palin who don't believe in evolution. This gut bacteria evolved in the last 20 years in the presence of antibiotics in animal gut, presumably in animals' guts, and is now killing people. Didn't exist 30 years ago.
Yeah, 70% of all antibiotics are given to animals, and principally on factory farms.
Right.
But so there are also other public health issues, like, you know, concentrating hundreds of thousands of animals on a factory farm, or even in the case of some of these birds, more than a million. There's one operation in Riverside County, California, Norco, the biggest funder to the opponents of two. They've got 8 million birds. When you put that much waste in one place and then you don't treat the waste, and they don't treat the waste, it seeps into the groundwater, it putrefies the air. The neighbors of these factory farms are revulsed by them, and they have flies, they've seen their property values drop. So we're working on the Yes on Proposition 2 campaign. The website is www.yesonprop2.com.
Okay.
And we're working hard to reach every Californian to vote yes. And we urge you know, almost everybody around the country knows people in California, so contact them. Go to our website, yesonprop2.com, and spread the word to promote animal welfare, to promote protection of the environment, to promote public health and safety, and to promote the protection of these rural communities that are being damaged by these factory farms. Vote yes on Prop 2.
Very well said. Wayne Pacelli, the president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, hsus.org, of course, their website, but yesonprop2.com, the website. Wayne, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Great talking with you. And let me also add, in addition to Proposition 2, again, you know, the ballot wars going on in California, as they are all over the United States, please vote no on Prop 8. So that's you know, let's give some human rights to our humans as well. I mean, it's, you know, let's let our gay brothers and sisters get married. This is just basic stuff. Anyhow, Aaron in Los Angeles. Hey, Aaron, got a minute before the break here. What's up, Aaron? No, Aaron.
Hello.
Hey, Aaron, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I'm kind of going back to your previous topic. If you're off of the propositions,
mm-hmm.
I didn't want to divert
sure.
from those important topics. Yeah, you were talking about the terms democracy and republic.
Right.
And I too find it to be very important. And I just kind of want to get your take on what you thought about the term oligarchy republic.
Yeah, I think we've increasingly become an oligarchic republic,
or
as we were in the 1880s, by the way.
Well, I think decreasingly, because, I mean, at first only rich white men could vote, and then, non-whites got to vote, and then
right.
the women got the right to vote. And so
right.
we're decreasingly becoming less of an oligarchic republic.
I'd say we became less of an oligarchy steadily up until around the 1980s, and then with a couple of Supreme Court decisions, which gave corporations, you know, the right to speak and the right to inject political money into campaigns and
right. That was going to be my next point,
you know.
But we're still an oligarchy republic because the big money gets the first.
I think we're becoming
right
more of one. And Obama is promising to roll that back, which I'd love to see. And John McCain.
Well, full public financing campaigns, I think, is the key to that.
Yes, absolutely.
To an actual true democratic republic, we need
yes.
that.
Yes, absolutely, Aaron, and well said. We have to do that. And it's working very well, by the way, here in the city of Portland, where we have voter-owned elections. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Faded off to sleep, and somewhere in the darkness, the gambler, he broke even, but in his final words, I found an ace that I could keep. But knowing when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em.
Yeah, William Crystal today, the New York Times, suggesting that the gambler, John McCain, who has been known to spend 11, 12 hours straight at a craps table, losing tens of thousands of dollars, should fold it. To just shut down his campaign and tell him to go back to the states and counties and get involved in local voter registration and getting the vote out rather than running the kind of campaign he's been running. And it seems that maybe they're going to, well, at least they've changed their tone. They're now talking about abortion instead of, somewhat changed their tone. They're talking about abortion instead of William Ayers. Gee, big, big change. Karen Nussbaum is with us. She's the executive director of the AFL-CIO's Working America campaign. WorkingAmerica.org is their website. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We have talked about Working America many times on this program, but we've just added, just today, four new radio stations to our lineup, and we constantly are adding new listeners. We just recently added a new 50,000-watt station in Dallas. Give us a quick overview, again, of what Working America is all about.
Working America is the community affiliate of the AFL-CIO. We go out into neighborhoods around the country and we talk to people who don't have the benefit of a union on the job, organize them in their communities, and give them a voice in politics and issues.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying you organize them, but my understanding was it's sort of the other way around, that if I am not a member of a union, and actually I am, but if I was not a member of a union and I wanted to participate with the AFL-CIO in the great work that you guys are doing, although I can't get all the benefits of union membership in my place of work, I can still join Working America by going to workingamerica.org and be a part of this movement. And, in fact, millions of Americans have done that.
You betcha. And that's exactly the beauty of it, that we are available to anybody who doesn't have a union to get some power behind them around good jobs and a just economy, and it's as easy as going to our website, workingamerica.org.
You know, Karen, it seems to me, I was on Fox News this weekend debating a conservative about ACORN. You know, this whole ACORN is, frankly, in my opinion, is a great community organizing group. They have 13,000 employees, and they've managed to get a few bad apples, as any organization with 13,000 employees will. But, you know, the bottom line is that I think that this whole the vote is being stolen thing that the Republicans are ranting about is an end game strategy, beyond the end game, that they already know that they've lost the presidency and that what they're doing is they're trying to set up a delegitimization of the Obama presidency so that day one when Obama is president, they can say, oh, he's not really the legitimate president. Therefore, we don't have to go along with his legislative programs. Therefore, we're not going to participate. They're going to do what, frankly, I think the Democrats should have done in 2000 when the Supreme Court handed the presidency to George W. Bush, but didn't have the chutzpah to do. But in my opinion, the Republicans definitely will. And therefore, we need to have a well-organized progressive majority to give the Democrats some wind to their back to get them moving on a real progressive agenda for America. Am I making sense, Karen?
You are. In fact, why don't you come work here at Working America? You're doing a great job.
I'm with you. I'm absolutely with you.
This election will be won only if it's about the economy. And that's the, people can still be sidetracked in this. I would not agree with you that it's in the bag. I think that it's
no. I don't. I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying that the Republican strategy right now is if it's in is. I think that this whole ACORN thing was not set up to help. There's no way it's going to help McCain or Palin, or even increase the turnout. What it's going to do, I think that they're focusing on that so that after the election, if Obama's elected, they can use that to say, we don't have to pay attention to this guy.
Right. We need to make this election about the economy. We need to be active on the day after the election on the economy. We need to make it clear that people have a stake in really solving these problems, not in backbiting. And it's that kind of momentum that's going to actually heal this country. What we're seeing with the McCain campaign is really ugly, as you were saying. And we can't let that drive a wedge in this country. We really have the promise of actually trying to heal both these rifts, but also, more importantly, the total destruction of the of the economy as actually working for people over the last several decades. We have to bring it back and make sure that the economy works for people, not people working for the economy.
Yeah, amen. And we have to keep in mind what an economy is. An economy, why we the people would create the infrastructure, you know, the court system and the monetary system, everything for an economy. We do it so that middle class people can realize the American dream of being able to put your kids through school and own a home and have a decent pension when you retire. We don't do it so that a couple of billionaires can become multi-billionaires.
And that's why 2.5 million people have joined Working America, and I hope more of your listeners will come to our website and do it as well, workingamerica.org.
There you go, workingamerica.org. Karen Nussbaum, the executive director of the AFL-CIO's Working America campaign. It's really a great program. If you haven't signed up, if you're not participating, get over there to workingamerica.org right now. Thank you, Karen.
Great, thank you.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
I've been riding down a two-lane highway.
be a good idea. 34 minutes past the hour. Hey, don't forget, Friday night at 7 o'clock for our listeners in the San Fernando Valley, the Democratic Party of the San Fernando Valley, dpsfv.com, their website. I need to double-check that and make sure it's not .org. Anyway, it's I will be there doing a fundraiser speech and a book signing. And then on the 19th, on Sunday, from 2 to 4 in the afternoon, in the L.A. area, in Bel Air, at American Jewish University, I will be speaking along with Stephanie Miller. The two of us will be debating a couple of conservatives. And for that, if you want to register, there's a phone number that you've got to call to register for that, to show up. I believe it's free. There may be a small fee. I'm not sure. In any case, the telephone number is 310-440-1246. 310-440-1246. And that phone number is on our website over at tomhartman.com if you want to track it down. Anna in Humboldt County, California. Hey, Anna.
Hi, Tom. It's great to talk to you. I'm calling about the whole Columbus Day thing. Mm-hmm. My name is Anna O, and that in Taino means mountain flower, and I am a direct descendant of the Tainos.
This is the Native American tribe that lived on Hispaniola.
Hispaniola, Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
Cuba.
A number of islands. Yeah.
Quite a few of the islands there. We are not extinct. I hate that word, because in order for us to be extinct, there wouldn't be any humans on the planet.
Yeah, well, I said on that island.
Oh, no. I didn't say you said it, but a lot of people say it all the time, and I hear it quite often. Yeah. Thing is, my grandfather was born in 1863 and lived till 1976. And he lived to be 113 years old. And that's approximate, because what happened was that his parents died from the pox, and he was found running around. So he was probably a couple years old when they found him, and they slapped the birth certificate on him and gave him to a family as a servant, and he was given a Spanish last name, and he remembers. He remembers, because in the island of Puerto Rico is like a giant mountain sticking out of the ocean, and it took a long time to get all the Tainos way up on the top of that mountain. And the United States didn't get possession of Puerto Rico until 1898 in the Spanish-American War, and he was still, actually, when he was born, he was not part of the United States. I sat down with that man and watched the spacewalk, and my mother grew up hiding up there when people came around, and she still uses words like nagua, which in Taino means a little skirt that the married women wore. That's what she calls a slip to this day. She and her sister talk about how the yucca plant was the size of a man's leg, and they had to process it. They made these nets, and they processed it, and took the poison out. So one thing I just, wanted to kind of dispel, not for you, I'm sure, you understand history pretty good. I'm a big fan of yours, and I am a big fan of the Constitution. I believe it's a good bunch of laws that are meant to help things be more smooth. And I love this country. But Columbus Day, I don't send my kids to school on Columbus Day. And pretty tired of hearing that we are gone. And also, I think, Puerto Rico is one of the oldest colonies in North America. It's still a colony. I mean, it can be called a commonwealth, but what's the difference, really?
Anna, I got it.
Yeah.
And thank you very much. You said it very, very well, and you're right. The Tainos are not gone, although Columbus did a very good job of destroying them on the island of Hispaniola.
Yeah, we were told I was told we were extinct in school. I didn't even realize the connection.
Yeah, no, it was just that island. But a good point, and thank you very much for making it. I appreciate the call. Matt in Pasadena, California. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Tom. The story, I'm a little nervous actually even talking about this story, but the story about McCain calling his wife the worst word you can call a woman in front of three reporters.
Yeah.
I think
that's been verified.
Oh, okay, because I know he didn't deny it at a rally because the questioner used the actual word. He was able to go, we don't appreciate that kind of language. I think people kind of miss the point sometimes because of the sensational nature of it. It's the fact, to me, the important part is that obviously, had that been reported, it would have been political suicide to have done that. And he couldn't stop himself. So for periods of time, however short, he literally could not stop himself from doing things he knows.
And this is what Robert Greenwald was talking about. He has anger management issues. It might be post-traumatic stress disorder. It might just be the way he was born. But this is a guy who flies off the handle in ways that are often violent, if not physically, at least verbally, and behaves very, very erratically. And, Matt, thank you for pointing that out. As we've seen from his campaign, you know, oh, we're going to suspend the campaign. Now we're back on the air. Now we're going to do this. Now we're going to do that. Now we're in favor of immigration. Now we're against immigration. Now we're in favor of bailouts. Now we're against bailouts. Now we're in favor of them again. He's a riverboat gambler, guys, with an anger problem. Kurt in Fairfield, California. Hey, Kurt.
Hi, Tom. Listening to you on the Green 960 out here.
Great. Thank you.
Listen, I wanted to bring up McCain's gambling problem. Dave Kolkin, a renowned odds maker in Las Vegas, used to have a radio show on KDWN. Your Las Vegas listeners will know what that is. And he mentioned that McCain lost about $1 million at one or two casinos and that his wife, Cindy, had to bail him out. Now, then the other co-host said, well, you know, let's get back to the odds maker. Let's talk about the Lions, you know, et cetera. And so this thing was just kind of dropped. I was hoping Nevada people make a big deal. I've called different politicians from Harry Reid's office to Oscar Goodman to some people in Reno I know. And no one wants to go on the record because they're not going to spite their own industry just to cut McCain's legs out.
Well, and one of the kind of unwritten rules of the gambling industry is, you know, the old what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, that, you know, what happens in the casino stays in the casino. But it's no secret that McCain has a severe gambling problem. And in fact, and thank you for pointing it out, the cover story in this week's Rolling Stone magazine, or newspaper, or whatever you call it, magazine, I guess, is about the real John McCain. And it's a startling, it's frankly a rather horrifying portrait that's sketched there. That you can read the story. Scott in Aurora, Colorado. Hey, Scott.
Hello, Tom. How are you doing this afternoon?
Just great, but I'll get better.
I'm doing great.
Good.
I am a volunteer for the Barack Obama campaign here in Arapahoe County. And Arapahoe County has kind of become the bullseye of Colorado. And I want to say that as a volunteer, I have made a difference. And getting active does make a difference because we have flipped this county from a majority Republican county to 2,000 registered Democrats above Republicans.
Wow, that's great.
And, you know, I wanted to say that getting active does make a difference. And I was at a Get Out the Vote meeting yesterday, and my team leader told me a story that apparently he heard from Tip O'Neill mm-hmm. about a guy that's driving down a country road and crashes his car in the ditch. And, you know, he's in the middle of nowhere, and hears the clip-clop of a wagon coming by. And the farmer with a huge pulling horse pulls over and says, whoa, Charger. And he comes out and goes, well, what do you need? He says, well, I need to pull my car out of the ditch. So the farmer unhooks his horse and hooks the horse up to the car, and he says, pull, Bessie. Pull, Bronco. Pull, Brontus. And then he goes up to the horse and he says, pull, Charger. And the Charger pulls the horse out of the ditch, or the car out of the ditch, and the guy's just amazed. And he goes up to the farmer and he says, well, why did you say all those other horses' names? And he says, well, Charger's blind. If he didn't know there were other people around him pulling, he wouldn't have pulled himself. Which I thought was a very, very...
It's a sweet metaphor. That's a very good one. Scott, thank you.
We all need to get involved.
Yeah, we do. Scott, thanks for sharing that with us. I remember calling up Dennis Weaver. He was an old friend of mine who I'd known for 30 years from SRF days, and the actor. And in fact, I wrote the foreword to his autobiography, The Whole World's a Stage, and which I think is still in print. Yeah, he's recently died. And I remember this was, I think, about 4 years ago, around the time of the last election. I called up Dennis and I said, Dennis, you know, some days it just seems like, you know, I can't do enough. It's like, you know, it's just a little overwhelming. And he said, Tom, we've just all got to pull our own wagons. He said, if each one of us just pulls our own wagon, we'll get across these mountains. We'll get across that, you know, we'll get across the West. We'll make it. But each one of us, we just have to keep our focus on what we're doing. And it was such a great metaphor. And I miss Dennis Weaver. Stuart in West Seattle, listening on KPTK. Hey, Stuart, got about a minute before the break. What's up?
Yeah, this morning you mentioned that the Northern Europeans have much higher voting rates than the Americans, but you neglected to mention one of the biggest reasons they vote in such high rates compared to Americans. They can actually elect people that represent their values and priorities.
Right, because they have proportional representation.
They have proportional representation, exactly.
But we're not going to get that because that would require a constitutional amendment. But what we can do, you know, Australia has a 98% voting rate because, A, they hit you with a $25 traffic ticket if you don't vote. And if you don't vote in several elections in a row, it starts going up really fast. And, B, they have instant runoff voting nationwide. Which produces essentially the same result as proportional representation. And I'll tell you, this is one of the reasons why I support the Green Party as well as the Democratic Party. Because the Green Party is doing great work. Over 300 communities across the United States, the largest being San Francisco. 300 communities now have instant runoff voting or variations thereof. And then, of course, there's also fusion voting in New York, another great thing. 45 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
For each other here. We're all in this together. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Your radio support group for We the People. 866-303-2270, our number. Mike in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Sorry I missed you when you came to Madison at seminar. I hope you make a visit again soon. The reason why I'm calling...
I intend to in the spring.
Okay, great. I will be there. The reason why I'm calling today is that the... Palin and McCain rhetoric has put a target on people like me who drive down the road with their progressive stickers on. I was involved in an altercation today. The gentleman actually backhanded me through my window with his notebook, and I reacted and regretted it the minute I did, but I knocked him down.
Hmm.
The police got involved. I called them. He apparently ran to it. I would imagine my stature at 5'5", 150 pounds, and his 5'10", 260, whatever. But I told him I thought this was generated just because of the bumper stickers, and they said that it was no doubt, and that they were starting to deal with a trend like this where they were getting more and more calls. I admitted that I got out of my car and punched him, and then the officer asked me if I knocked him down, and I hung my head and said yes, and they whispered in my ear, "Nice punch." The tickets, no tickets were issued. We shook hands. We apologized. I said, the next time I see you, I'll wave. But the point I'm making is that I put myself at risk just by responding to their reaction. But this, again, has all gone back to the campaign of Palin. And I say Palin McCain because she's the one who actually fits this mode perfectly. She loves her speak. I think McCain is probably going to regret a lot of this when it's over and said, but Palin is a nightmare.
She is George Bush with lipstick.
Absolutely. I mean, she has no education, no couth, no real responsibility in life. I mean, she's been pampered her whole life. She doesn't know Constitution. She doesn't know law, and she doesn't know fairness. I mean, that is a real bad combination for us.
Beauty queen for vice president, and her husband's a stalker. Mike, thank you very much for sharing the story. It's a grim reality that these guys are whipping up hate and fear in the United States the same way that they did in Germany in the 30s, and really that's the largest one. I mean, it's been done 1,000 times. times through history. These are the tactics of a tin pot, tin horn dictator, and it's tragic, and America is better than that. Mike, thank you very much. Andre in Washington, D.C. Hey, Andre, what's up?
Hey, buddy. Just kind of talk a little bit more of the whole Christopher Columbus situation, and I find it, you know, yeah, it's the irony being the whole situation. We're celebrating this guy's day, you know, and, you know, he was just an idiot. He found us by mistake. But I said us because, I was born and raised in the island in St. Croix, and, it's a U.S. territory, as you know, and I wanted to make sure a lot of Americans out there realize who may not know, and of course I know you probably know that, Puerto Rico and St. Croix, those are two only U.S. pieces of land or land masses that Christopher Columbus ever touched.
And Hispaniola.
That's not part of the U.S. land. I'm talking about the contiguous 48 states, nothing, just the two U.S. territories, the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico and St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Other than that, he never set foot on the contiguous 48 or Alaska or Hawaii for that matter. So, you know, I always find it, you know, ironic that they celebrated, then the man never came to the states. And last but not least, just again, another point to make sure all Americans know, the whole reason why we call Native American Indians today is because, again, the man's an idiot. He was sailing the wrong direction. He came across folks and he thought they were Indians, and he called them Indians. And
right,
now, 5 years
an Indian.
Later, and everyone in America is going to call Indians Indians when, you know, the guy just, he was a bum. He was like the George Bush of his time.
Yeah, good point, Andre. Columbus isn't quite the conquering hero that we thought or that we were taught or whatever. And in fact, America is actually named after the guy who made the maps that either Columbus used or that were based on Columbus's explorations, Amerigo Vespucci. And, you know, he signed on the map in the corner, he signed it Amerigo Vespucci, and somebody looked at it and said, what is this kind? Oh, it must be Amerigo. And it became America. It's like, I love that. There's a one piece in the Firesign Theater's Waiting for the Electrician or Someone Like Him album where they sing, God bless Vespucci land. It's Mary in Campbell, California. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I want to go back to your first hour when you were talking about health care. One thing I never hear anybody talk about, especially with McCain and his $5,000 tax credit to purchase any kind of insurance you want to buy, there are some of us who cannot get insurance. Mm-hmm. I am one of them. I had cancer nearly 20 years ago.
John McCain is one of them.
Pardon me?
John McCain is one of them.
Yeah,
he wouldn't qualify for insurance under his own plan.
Yeah, he's rich enough to get anything that he wants, though. I even joined the National Association for the Self-Employed because they had a group health insurance, and I got turned down. I cannot get a health insurance company to quote me an outrageously expensive monthly premium, let alone get insurance. Mm-hmm. So when they keep talking, Democrats and Republicans, about it should be between the patient and their doctor, well, hell, sometimes you can't get a doctor.
Right. It's not just an insurance problem or an uninsured problem or an underinsured problem. It's also an uninsurable problem.
That's a big uninsurable problem.
Yeah, Mary, very well said. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Coming up tomorrow, Brad O'Leary, president of ATI News. We're going to talk about trade. And Pajama Media Express blogger Victor Davis Hanson. He's calling for Kim McCain to ramp up his personal attacks on Obama's past. Say what? What happened to the issues? Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. And our article on Columbus, by the way, is on our Air America page. You can check that out at airamerica.com. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit hartmanradio.com.